Right, so we're going to deal with a challenging topic. The topic of God's divine providence, or the Hebrew term hashkacha. God's, literally, hashkacha means to watch over. Like you have a mashkiach in a restaurant, he's making sure all the food is kosher. So when we say God is mashkiach, he's watching, he's taking note of what's happening in the world of human affairs. Okay? So this is an area which is of tremendous interest to everyone. And it's also a tremendous misunderstanding. It's not such a very, it's not a clear area. And what we want to try to do is make some clarity in this area as best we can. And but before I get into that, I just want to, you know, just get in general, when you say that, when you say that, you know, God is watching, or God is, or God is intervening. How do you understand that? Let's just start off with what are people's general expectations? What are people's general feelings about that? Anybody want to take a stab? I'll pick on David tonight. Why not? What do you think? What are people's thoughts about that?
His thoughts or general people's thoughts?
No, your thoughts about what do you think are people's general positions on this, on the, on this matter?
I mean, I'd say that, you know, a lot of people think that, you know, every little thing that happens is God's, you know, God's will, and he's intervening in every little detail of one's life. And I think there are people that would say that anything that happens is because, you know, God's making it happen like this.
Now, one second. So now we have to make this. I'm glad you brought that up. Now, there's a very important distinction here. We talk about God. Now, we also have God's hashgacha, but then we also have God's knowledge. There's a very important distinction. Is God aware of everything what's happening?
Yes.
Okay, so that's a fundamental of Judaism, that God is, in contrast to our founding fathers of America, who what they call, they were deists, they maintain that God created the universe, and he has nothing to do with it, essentially. So it's like he set up a machine, and he walked away.
Who says that?
So that's the position of a group of philosophers who are deists, and many of them, like Jefferson and Benjamin Franklin, were the people who founded this country. They maintain there is God, and their God exists, and he's actually even the creator, but he has no involvement whatsoever in the day-to-day activities of mankind. Okay, it's a category of, it's a possibility, okay? So we as Jews, we maintain that God is omniscient. He knows everything which is happening. Now, not in the same way that we know, because he's never, this is a very important point, just a very basic distinction. What's the difference between our knowledge and his knowledge?
There's no limit to his knowledge.
Okay.
And we're limited with what we know.
Okay, first of all, his knowledge is complete.
What does that mean, though?
Okay, so the key distinction of that is this is actually, well, ultimately, we don't know what that means fully, but there's one aspect of that which, insofar as making the distinction, there's a very big distinction. In other words, Lauren can go from a state of not knowing to knowing, and that's a change, okay? Which is also saying that the knowledge, any knowledge, is external to you. Mm-hmm. When we talk about Hashem, his knowledge, the knowledge itself, his knowing, are all one.
Yeah, because he knows from beginning to end.
He knows from beginning to end. And there's nothing new, so therefore he also has knowledge of the future.
Right.
Okay, so it's all known to him. Okay? Now, of course, it deals, of course, I'm not getting into a lot of implications about free will and God's knowledge. There's all kinds of interesting conversations that are in discussions that we can have concerning that. But so that's one thing. So we maintain that God is A, all knowing, and B, I just want to separate what our conversation is and what our conversation is not. And also we say that God is a shofet, he is a judge. So not only does he know everything which happens, but he judges all the human action. And that results in reward and punishment. Sometimes in this world, sometimes in the next world, and sometimes in both. Okay? So I'm limiting the conversation to a specific point of really, which is God's intervention in daily life. Okay? What we call hashgacha pratit. There's hashgacha, there's another, I'm going to throw out another term, hashgacha klalif, from the word klal, which is dealing with the everything, which is really, another way you'd label it is the laws of nature, how he runs the universe. He gives gravity and the forces of light and the nuclear forces and all the forces that we see in our world. Those are his laws that he runs the world with. Okay, that's termed hashgacha klalit, over the klal, the general laws. But then hapratit means a specific law, which applies only to mankind. Okay, so now we get into the area which is, okay, you say that God can intervene on behalf of mankind. And here comes the million-dollar question, which is, of course, what Dave brought in, is that it's common to believe, let me give you a situation. Imagine I'm driving in downtown West Hempstead, and it is, I'm running late, and I see, lo and behold, somebody pulls out of a parking spot in front of EJ's 2. And I just zip right in and able to get to that pizza 11 seconds earlier. Is that an expression of God intervening in the traffic patterns of West Hempstead, ensuring that I, Pinky Rosenthal, have pizza 11 seconds earlier? Okay? Is God involved? Now, certainly we're about to celebrate Pesach. Certainly, without any question, God intervenes in human in history because we have the ultimate intervention of all time, which is the whole Yetzias Mitzrayim, is the ultimate intervention. He takes a nation who is a slave state, a nation within a nation. He does it via breaking the laws of nature, ten plagues, and extracting them from Mitzrayim. So that's certainly Hashgacha Pratis. Now that, everybody agrees about that. But the question is, what you'll hear... we're going to put under the microscope tonight, try to get some clarity on. I'd like to accomplish when it's legitimate to say that a person is functioning within the realm of Hashgacha Pratis, and when not. Not necessarily that we have a Hashgacha Amid, you can detect, oh, that is an act of divine intervention. And try to explore these areas as best as we can, which is a very, by definition, somewhat of a murky area. Okay, but let me ask you a question. Which side is the most, why do you think the idea of Hashgacha Pratis, as described by David, is so emotionally appealing?
Like, anyone would want the feeling of the security, knowing that God, so to speak, is on their side.
Right. And doing
so
what?
Comforting and like protecting them, taking care of them, making sure they're safe, making sure nothing bad is going to happen to them.
In every situation.
Right. So every little thing they believe is from God.
Right.
Daddy.
He's intervening.
Right.
Daddy.
Now, so it's it, but so we're trying to, so you're saying psychologically, right, Sammy there is saying
that's holding my hand.
Right, so going back from early youth, when a child is, imagine a child is walking with their parents and in the mall, and it's during the Christmas season, and there is myriads and myriads of people. And this little 7-year-old boy looks up, and he sees nothing but a sea of people. But at that moment, he feels the connection between him and his father's hand detach. And he stops and he looks around and he doesn't see his father. So describe his feeling at that moment.
Terror.
Absolute terror. Right. His whole world, he's now lost in a sea of strange people. And he is completely vulnerable. And until his father grabs his hand again 60 seconds later, he's in a state of complete panic. Okay? So the comforting thought of having your father take father or parent care of you is something which is a natural feeling. And it's also natural to imagine that God relates us in the exact same way. Okay, the question is that true? Yeah. Okay, so we're going to work. So we're not just going to guess, we're going to look at the primary sources. We're not going to just throw out. Because now, let me ask you a question. Let's take it the other way. What is the emotional side of saying that man is really, man is really not under, let's take the other side, that man is not under God's supervision / intervention?
Then they go, they have no limits. They don't have any repercussions or the way they think that they're not going to get in trouble for what they're doing and they can get away with anything.
Daddy's away, I'm free! Right. So basically the feeling that there's a counter emotion, which is either the person wants daddy holding hand or they want to know the joy of the teenage boys as they look at their parents, car backing out on the way to a 2-week holiday far away. And the other brother signals to the other brother that, in fact, that the coast is clear and let's turn up the tunes because there is some serious parting to happen. Okay, so the bottom line is there's both, we have to be honest here, we have to put both emotional perspectives. These people who want the emotional hug of the parent throughout the totality of their lives, or a person who, quite frankly, wants daddy the heck away because I got some things to do, which you do not want him involved in. Okay, so they're both emotional. There are two emotional pendulums here that we have to be honest about. So we need to assess. Now, as we said before, in other words, one of the primary principles, which I don't think there's any dispute about, is that God has a knowledge of all of human affairs and does a judgment. You understand? There's a distinction between human judgment versus is he going to intervene on your behalf or not on your behalf. Okay, those are two distinctive points. Okay, so we're trying to limit the conversation, trying to
I have a quick question.
Go ahead. We'll take a quick question.
Wouldn't you say that the person that believes that God's always intervening and like helping them out in different situations, that isn't that kind of being very haughty? Because who are they to have God's intervention?
Right. So one could argue that, well, ultimately that's real, like a child. A child is the most egocentric being there is. Because when a baby's born, they view their mother as an extension of themselves. it's only after 2 years when there's the mother-child separation they start to become their own separate ego. But still, everybody else, instead of being part of them, now becomes a tool of them. And for many people, that never ends, as you may meet in life. But in other words, they see, everything is really instrumental for their satisfaction, whatever it is. You have a candy, I need it. You know what I mean? You have a toy, I'm taking it away from you. So until the child sees a broader picture of the world, they start to develop. So that can be a childish notion, yes. Going back on the psychological bit, because they want to have, because just as a child is egocentric, so if you want to maintain a child state, that is an egocentric perspective, psychologically speaking.
Yeah, but not even talking about psychologically. What about, someone who's, a wise person? Why would they suspect that, God's on their side if you have to be on a certain level to have God?
Well, we're going to explore that. We're going to get down to the details. The text we're going to use, and we could use many different texts, is we're going to take the Ramban. He discusses on many areas, and I'm not trying. I don't want to. It's not such a simple. In contrast to the Ramban wrote in Mor Nevuchim a very. He writes out in a very clear way. This is his position. Boom, boom, boom. The Ramban, you have to figure out like clues. He has a little comment here, a little comment there, and you got to put it all together. And I'm not here to try to necessarily answer every question on the Ramban on every single time he talks about Hashkafa, which is about 5 or 6 times throughout his commentary on the Chumash. But one of the most presentation and just explain what Hashkafa practice is a commentary on Eov. And it's not talking about the totality of Eov, but Eov says, there's a pasuk in Eov says, Lo Yigra Mitzadik Enov. God does not pull away his eyes, or hold back his eyes from the righteous. That's, okay, so already that's a, but you can make a deduction there. Just off the surface. He does not pull, he does not remove his eyes from the righteous. What is the obvious deduction?
That only the righteous are under his guidance.
Are constantly under his care and surveillance. Okay, that's the opening, just the most overt thing. So from that okay. So I'm going to hand out those who want to. I'm going to read along with this. I got a couple of copies. Those who want to read along, it's in the Hebrew. There is no English translation of this, so I'm going to translate for everybody's benefit if they want. There we go. Okay. So there's a little piece cut off, but I'm just going to get to it. He says, there are many psukim that talk about this issue of hashkacha. He says like this. This is in Perek Lamed Vav, 36th chapter of Pasuk Zayin. He says like this. I'm going to look at now. We're at the top of the top right paragraph. We just missed like two words. So it says, Ki Anshei HaTorah, that men of Torah, Va'amunah Tamima, and the complete conviction or faith, Yaminu Bashkacha. One maintains that there is divine providence or watching. Ki Akel, that God, Yashkiya Yishmor Anshe Min Ha'adam, that God watches, and this is the key word, Yishmor, and guards, and protects men of the human species. Okay? So first principle is, what makes unique about being a Jew, is that we maintain that God does guard men of mankind. Okay? Kamosha Katuv, he quotes the pasuk in your mail, Gadol Ha'etzah Rov Ha'aliliya Asher Einecha Pekuchos Al Kol Darkei B'nei Adam, that God's eyes are open, as it were, on all the pathways of man, Laseis Le'ish Bidrachav, to give man in his path, Kapri Maliosav, and the fruit, literally, or the result of his plans. He gives another passage. Amar David, and David said, Ki kol havot doresh Hashem, v'chol yitzer machshavos mevin. V'lo bo b'tor okay, so let me just start, because that's another quote. Okay, v'lo bo b'tor o b'nevua, Sheakel Mashkiach v'shomer anshe shar abrios, shenim b'dabros. Here's the first key point. You know, this is many questions. You know, there's a practical application to this. You will not find in the entire Torah in any statement in the prophets that God watches and guards beings from other creatures who do not speak. So very simply. So let me make the Rak shomer et haklalim b'klal hashamayim b'tzvam. He just watches them as he maintains all their species in a general way. Let me make a very simple example. Person has a pet who they love deeply. Okay? Which is millions of Americans. And
more than their kids.
That often is true. Sadly. And lo and behold, their dog, in a moment of just complete randomness, runs down the street and gets struck by a car. Okay? Was that a lack of divine guarding? Or was that meant to be? What is the implications about what the Ramban says about non-humans?
It was just the way the world, like, it was under the laws of nature.
That's it. He's in the wrong place at the wrong time, and now he's not. He's.
The implications are that there's no divine intervention associated with animals.
For their own sake. Or God could, for example, use an animal for the benefit of. We have that in Tanakh. You have to use an animal for the benefit of mankind.
But the animals benefit.
Right. God's not going to swoop down and stop the Lexus in the middle of Peninsula Boulevard and make sure that little, you know, Snippy the dog does not end his life at this particular point in time. All right? That is not within our system here. God does not. He is left to the world of laws of nature, to the world of chance. That's it.
Did he say only for animals or for a being that can't talk?
Right. Yes, yes.
Yeah, but that's the same thing.
It is.
It's left me the person who can't speak.
No. Okay, you can explain that. Let's go on then. Therefore, he has an interesting point. Hold on, he's gonna elucidate that a little further. Let's get the Ramban a little bit more of a chance here. He says, therefore, hutra hashkita. Therefore, the Torah permitted slaughtering of animals. Lutzarachon for the sake of man. Vegam lekaper al nashosenu, and to atone for our souls. Bidamam al namizbeach with their blood on the altar. Vatam hazeh. Yadua ubarur. This reason is clear and known. Ki adam ibneshu makiras elokav. Since man knows his God, yeshkiach alav yishmoroso. He will guard him. Velo kein shar habriyos. Not the case of the rest of the creatures. Sheina medabros ve'ena yodim boram. So the measurement right already here already is the reason that Skippy the dog did not get saved, because he categorically has a problem. It's not because he cannot communicate, because first of all, dogs do have a measure of communication. Their barking means something, maybe to other dogs. I don't really know, but that's definitely communication. Not that he doesn't. It's not his lack of communication. Is that within the being, which is the dog, he does not have which we call tzel melokim, which can apprehend that there is a creator. It does not have the mechanism to leave its little world. It's stuck in its little instinctual bubble, where there is. Little bowl of water. There's a little bowl of food. There's a little rubber toy. There's running around. You know, and there's fun days and not fun days. And that's the totality of their little world. And he can't, and he doesn't have a tool. He has no mechanism, no matter how much he would try, to burst out of that limiting bubble. He is stuck in the bubble. Okay? And being that, therefore, the Ramban is saying he is therefore a lower being.
What about like a monkey?
Same thing. Based upon his definition,
right?
Because he doesn't have the reason. In other words, otherwise, if he did, what would you not allow to do? Which is the argument. Which is an interesting. I'm going to now comply to a modern situation. If let's say animals did have an ability to have a perception about Hashem, what would you not allow to do with them?
Shaka.
Yeah, you'd have to treat them like humans. Because the fact that they are not as, you know, they are different than us would not be aids. That would not give us an excuse to make them into shoes, or to make them into
a
coat.
Are monkeys like geniuses?
There's a difference between, we have to see between cleverness and intelligence, which animal does have animal intelligence, versus the ability to engage in a certain degree of abstract thought, which is to be able to cognize that there is a first cause to the universe. That's a qualitative distinction. Now, I want to point out, for example, you may have heard about PETA, which is the Organization Against Animal Cruelty. Not only animal cruelty, but any animal killing. In fact, they had the famous statement about a year or two ago. They referred to the fact that, 10 or 20 million chickens are killed each year in America. And they referred to that as, and they got into trouble, and they said, that's the Holocaust on your dinner plate. Famous Holocaust on your dinner plate. So, because what are they equating? I'm a feeling being, and the chicken is a feeling being. It has emotions. So, what right do you have to end their life? They feel pain. You feel pain. They feel sad. You feel sad. They feel happy. You feel happy. So, within the realm of being a feeling, conscious being. There's no difference. And if you forbid human killing, there's no distinction between a human and an animal. What's the essence of their argument?
Man is essentially an animal.
Man is essentially an animal. Now, really, you could take the other approach. If you maintain animal, man is just an animal. Let's say you take what they would call a hardcore biological evolutionist position, which is man is purely just a more sophisticated animal. What really would you allow it to do? Shackman. Other one gets beyond the argument of what a social contract, which is maybe it's true, but we won't be able to exist as a civilization. But if you are alone on a desert island, and it's just you and another annoying guy, and it's not going to affect society because there is no society. If you're both just creatures, all you have left is what? One could argue you only have the survival of the fittest. So if I kill him, that's it. He's no different than a lion being munched by a deer. A lion munching a deer. The end. Done. One animal dominating the other, it's over. Okay? Is that clear? So this distinction is very critical. And he said, he makes it very clear that we'd have no right to use animals for our for food or for clothing or for anything or for the educational benefit or korbanos, nothing. Okay, is that clear?
Rambam saying that.
He's saying that what the Ramban is saying is only by virtue of the fact that animals do not have an ability to perceive Hashem categorically, therefore they're by definition a lower being, and therefore you're allowed to slaughter them for make them into a barrel of chicken wings. Okay, otherwise you have no right to do that.
You have to
honor them because he has that divine element. Okay, let's go on. Okay, this is a key thing. Now he says, "Minatama zeh," from this rationale, Yishmor etz hatzadikim, he will guard the righteous. Since you and their eyes are constantly with him, the God's eyes are upon them, the righteous, from the beginning of the year to the end of the year. Until the ultimate righteous guy, Chasid Gamor, Hadavik ve'elokav, that cleaves with his God, Tamid, constantly. He's constantly thinking about God to the exclusion of everything else. Okay? He makes the following thing. If you have an ultimate person, okay, the ultimate righteous person, since he's constantly preoccupied about thinking about Hashem, he's like indestructible. He cannot be hurt. He's like, you know, one of the fantastics, you know what I mean? He's like, he has absolute 100% 24/7 divine protection. He is indestructible. That doesn't mean that he's going to do stupid things. Obviously, it doesn't mean that guy at Tzadik Gomer, he's not going to walk in front of the bus. You know, that would make him automatically not a Tzadik because he's an idiot. Once you do something stupid, then you're automatically not a Tzadik. But I'm saying that person, since he's constantly preoccupied to cleave with Hashem and thinking about him continuously, that Hashem is thinking about him.
Now, so I understand this is only to the extent that he's thinking about God.
Yes.
This guy who's spending 20 hours a day doing this now goes to sleep for 4 hours. At that point, I don't know if we make a deduction that he's not under the, he might be destructible because or does he just,
it was unclear, but you could, you know, the Ram does talk about that a little bit in the Mora, you know. One could argue there's two possibilities. Either that, yes, during that time, not. It's either literally that state of being itself is a state where one would get absolute perfect intervention and protection no matter what. Or that's the character of the guy.
Okay.
Doesn't mean that he's answering the phone and his mom is calling him and telling him to pick up some milk. Doesn't mean that first of all, it's a mitzvah. Okay, first of all, person picks up the phone, mom tells him to pick up milk, that's a mitzvah mitaraisa. One should not look down upon that. We have a mom in the audience. Give it up for mom. Okay, so let's go on. He jacks up even a level higher. Vishdamer mayam benes, yasalotamit, but be guard even with a miracle. Constantly. He'll be like considered like an angel who's like completely removed from the entire world of destruction and creation, you know, the elements of change of our natural order. Kifi Krevaso Idabek Belokav Yishtamer Shmir Mula. To the extent, here we get to the, now he starts giving the equation here. To the extent of the closeness with his God, he'll be given the most excellent guarding. Va'arach menakel, but a person who is distanced from God, ben machshavto, in his thought, uke and maisav, in his action, in his deeds. Afil lo yishaya misa, becheto, asher chato, even if he's not so bad that he would be he's worthy of the death penalty because of his sins. Ye mushlach v'nezav l'mikrim. He is now living in the world of causality. Okay? So here we have a direct... Now let's go back to my pizza example. Okay? So, if I'm preoccupied, if I'm thinking about Sicilian pizza, and I'm thinking about, boy, I really have Sicilian pizza like right now, and the fact that a car zips out of the spot and I zip in, and that's a fortunate situation. Based upon the Ramban's equation, I have no right to assume that fortunate situation on my behalf is something which has nothing to do with God's intervention, because he makes it very clear that God's intervention is directly proportionate to one's thought and actions about concerning Hashem. Now, because we have to take it a deeper question: why is Hashem helping this person? Let's take it a deeper thing. Why is Hashem helping this guy? So he's a tzaddik. He said, I mean, Avraham Avinu did not say, I'm going to be a tzaddik so that I'll get this payoff that if I get tossed into a fiery furnace, I won't get burnt. You know, like, you know, and if I get sent to Mitzrayim, the Egyptians are now going to give me lots of money, and then eventually God will do a miracle, and then they're going to give me my wife back, and I'm going to come back super loaded with cash. Okay? Avraham Avinu did not become Avraham Avinu because he wanted to have all these things happen on his behalf. The question is, why is there Hashkacha Pratis? Why is there divine providence for this person? And the key thing is, we see the Ramban points out there's a continuum. We have two poles. We have the person who is far from Hashem, who does not think about Hashem at all, either in his thought or in his actions. And the other person is only thinking about Hashem in his deed and his actions. You have two, and you have a big spectrum of people. Okay, you have the ultimate, we'll call the ultimate Russia dude, and the ultimate Sadik dude or dudette. Okay, so but let me ask the general question: why is Hashem helping that person? Ramban's not addressing that directly, but I think maybe you can think about that. Why is he helping? Forget about what extent. I don't want to know how much on the hashkachometer am I getting. Am I a 4? Am I a 6? Am I a 9? Am I a 2? Where am I reading today? Everyone knows, wants to get their hashkachometer and see. I am in a good shape. Hashem is going to be bailing me out. Okay? Why is that? I'm going to give you a little hint. The next pasuk really gives you a little nice hint. Vov is that sukkim rabim, and the Torah, in the Navi brings many verses to this idea. Amar David who wrote Shmuel Aleph, writes this actually quoting Chana. Chana wrote Ragli Chasidav Yishmor v'Rishoyim Techoshech Yidamu. That God watches over the goings, literally the feet of the righteous, and the wicked they stumble around in the darkness. And he explains, Amar ki hakrovim may love those who are close to him, betachlas hashmira in the goal of the guarding, darachokim men and those who are far away from him, mizumanu l'nikrim are set up to deal with the various chance happenings, veilem matzal menezek, and they will not be saved from damage. And like a guy who's stumbling around in the dark, trying to find the light. Asher nifilasto krova, who is very likely to stumble. Im lo yishtamer v'yilech la'at. If he's not careful and walks very slowly. Okay, why is Hashem helping out the righteous? Why should he?
Maybe they deserve. deserve it.
Why do they deserve it?
Well, they're working, you know, so hard to please Hashem, and, you know, everything is supposed to be, what you do in this lifetime is supposed to be for the next lifetime, so, you know, maybe he's just helping you along the way.
Helping in what way?
Whatever way they need.
Why? You're warm. Why? Just go a step further.
I know, I'm trying.
Okay. We're not going to pressure you. You're warm. I'm just going to give you the warm hint. Okay? Anyone want to add to that?
Could it be because it might be like an influence onto other people when other people look at this person. So then they see that they not only see you, you know, in the proper path, but he also has God's mishkacha with them. It's like,
you know, that's an extraneous reason. So you're saying, really, he doesn't deserve it.
No, he
But it will help others.
No, he does deserve it. He acts as a light onto
Okay, so is that an intrinsic reason or an extrinsic reason?
I'd say that'd be an extrinsic reason.
So let's see. Is there an inherent reason? Is there an inherent value?
Well, what about, you know, the expression, God helps those who help themselves?
Okay.
So, you know...
Is that always true?
Based
upon what the Ramban is talking about? Because this is very vague. What does it mean to help themselves? There is a truth to that statement, which means that Hashem does not want us to ignore the natural order and just say, like, you know, I'm going to stay in bed, and he'll wire money into my account, and I don't do anything. Okay? Okay? That's not how he set up his world, apparently. I tried, and lo and behold, I went online and nothing changed. So I'm here to tell you that does not work.
No, but if they were doing everything in their power to make good,
yes.
You know, somebody who works so hard and they give as much tzedakah as they possibly could, so they don't, but enough not that they're not broke. And if God sees how hard they're trying, you know, then why wouldn't you want to help this person out? I mean, just as a human being, if I see somebody, you know...
So is there, you're saying it's simply reward. I see reward, by the way, tzar and onesh are not necessarily... It's not the same thing here. That may be also true. There may be another dimension here. See, what he was said before is that Ragli Chassid of Yishmor, the goings of the righteous he guards... is because, first of all, there's another dimension here. If a person is a righteous person, by definition, the world is stacked against him. Okay? What happened, let's give a very modern example. What happened to all the analysts 2 years ago that went to their managers and said, you know, this entire collateral debt obligations, I know the computer saying we have very little risk. But it doesn't make any sense to me. We're giving money to people who we know can't pay it back. And then we're taking all those loans, we're putting them into big bundles, and we're selling it to all over the world, and people have the illusion it's based on loans that really are gonna be paid in full. What happened to those guys? And there were people. What happened to those people? They were fired. In fact, many have been, you know, as the financial explosion and has unfolded and has continued to unfold. First of all, they said they had the parents are like, Harry, you're not a team player. That was the first line. Second meeting, you're not really understanding our program. Third time is we're going in a different direction, and we don't really need your services anymore. So, if you're a person who's a tzaddik, you are by definition going to find opposition. When Avraham Avinu was sharing the ideas to the world that there is one God, did Nimrod, who was the king, oh, that is so wonderful. That's so clarifying. Why don't you share with that with all my. Why don't you run an entire educational system based upon your ideas? Did Nimrod have that response? What was Nimrod's response to Avram? And why? What happened to little Avram? What happened to Avram when he starts sharing his ideas with the population of Ur Kasdim. There are people that were being, there were a number of groups. Some people said, you know, Avram, you're on to something here, and they were, became his disciple. And according to the Midrash, there were actually 10,000 of such students. So how did Nimrod, who was according to the Midrash, and he was the leader of that city state? What was his reaction to Avram Avinu sharing these wonderful ideas? Did he say, you say tomato, and I say tomato? Whatever floats your boat, cool with me. Any, if that's the way you roll, that's fine. I don't care. Or he had somewhat of a different approach to that Avram's ideas. And what was those ideas? What was his approach? According to the Midrash, he took him and threw him in the fiery furnace. Or according to the, you know, the Ramban said, either that happened literally, or basically Avram escaped from Ur Kasdim in the dead of the night through a miracle. Because basically, Avram became a very dangerous person. Because let's work this out. If you're Nimrod, and you're a king, and you are also the religious leader, oh, there you go, on the money. On the money, honey. Because the bottom line is that Avram became what we call the enemy of the state. Because if people say like this, you are Nimrod, you are presenting yourself either as being a semi-god, or you're somehow connected to channeling these idolatrous, either the powers of the stars, you have some of this ability. And now Avram's saying that doesn't exist. What other lies are you telling us, Uncle Nimrod? So that's not something that's going to help Nimrod maintain his power over the population.
No, they'll resent him for being something he's not.
Right, so Nimrod had no choice but to get Avram. He had to kill Avram. It wasn't like, oh, you know, your ideas are nice, thoughtful, thank you for sharing. It was kill or be killed. Avram's ideas were extremely threatening. And they had to be, and Avram had to, and the source had to be exterminated. Okay, so therefore, if a person is a tzaddik, the person who's sharing these ideas will, by definition, meet opposition. Because he's going to come up against the forces of the powerful who are making money off it, i.e. corrupt finance people, who in the back of my mind know it's all baloney, but are racketed $25 million a year in commissions over complete fraud or legal fraud, whatever you want, however you want to categorize that. Or you're going to be a king who now has a control over a population who gives him money and honor. Not going to like that. So basically, a person's really a tzaddik, they are forced to confront evil, and they're by definition in harm's way. And what is Hashem saying? Raglei Chasidei Yishmor. He will guard them. Because without them, there will not be, you know, why? Very simple reason. There will not be any tzaddikim. They can't exist. What would happen to Judaism if Nimrod grabbed Avram by his collar and his belt and heaved him into the fiery furnace? We would not be here. That's it. Judaism would have had a very short life of 10 years. Done. Over. Okay? What would happen to the Jewish people in time of Mordechai and Esther? Done. He felt Mordechai did not want to not bow. It's not that he had an emotional distaste to bow down to Haman. He felt that it was his assessment that to bow down to Haman is to bow down to idolatry. And it's a non-negotiable point. So the bottom, based upon the laws of nature, you're dead. And that would have been the natural order if Hashem did not intervene on behalf of Mordechai and Esther and the Jewish people. So basically, it's not like the tzaddikim are Hashem's favorite people and we're just going to give you an extra cookie because you're nice. No. It's because a tzaddik and a tzaddikim cannot exist without Hashgacha Pratis. The world can exist if Peter Olden does not get to the Sicilian pizza 10 seconds sooner. That is not going to move the world to a greater apprehension of God's wisdom. So therefore, it's not subject to God's intervention. It's not what that intervention is there for. That divine kindness is there because without it, you would have no goodness in the world. The tzaddik needs that, or else he won't exist. He'll go up against the mighty, and he'll get wiped out. It's over. And there'll be no Judaism, and then you'll have a world which the world was right prior to the flood. Basically, people of stealing and robbery and adultery and every kind of conceivable crime you can imagine. That'll be the world. Basically, a nihilistic world full of anarchy and destruction. It would be a disaster. It would be the law. It would basically be the human law of the jungle, and that's it. So thus, Hashkacha is needed to maintain the balance of power, if you will, where the world has a chance to do a bechira by maintaining the people, the educational leaders, whoever they may be, either the Jewish people as a totality, or individual players, to the extent that they are a player, to help them out, or else they're not going to make it. It's going to be over. And there will be no human redemption. That is why. It's not going back to our original assumption. It's not that going back to our original metaphor. It's not the dad. It's not the experience of when I'm a child and I'm in the mall and my dad grabs me away from you know throngs of strangers. It's not about that. Or it's that I'm left to the laws of nature because I want to be free. It has nothing to do with it. It's really empower. It's giving the tzaddik or the people to the degree that they are partake of that. The key thing is like this. Now let's go back to developing our shkachometer. So to the extent that a person's thoughts and actions are moving in the direction of seeking Hashem or exploring these ideas to themselves and to others, then they are worthy of the help. Because that's what the help is there for. It's not just because Hashem has favorites. It's not about favorites. Do you understand what I'm saying? So therefore, there's a phrase in Chazal, Habal Latayr Misaimoso, one who really wants to improve themselves, wants to purify themselves. God will help them. Because that fits imperfectly. Because if their motivation is just that, they want that breakthrough, they can't do it themselves. They want that teacher, they want that book, they want that insight, they want that help, they want that dealing with an addiction. It could be a whole host of help, whatever that is for that person at that particular point. If they really, really want that, and that's their motivation, Hashem will help them. So every person is worthy of Hashkacha. Every person can get in Hashkacha Pratis. But it's not to have the daddy god on my side who's going to bail me out when I'm acting like an idiot. You know what I mean? I'm going to show to work late, and I'm going to not do work, and I'm going to play on my computer all day, and then I get and God should come down and save me from getting fired. I was a crummy employee. I was screwing around at work. Hashem is not going to help. It's not going to help me because I want to be like I want to act like a baby. That's not what Hashkacha is all about. But if I really want to make the human breakthrough, if I want to become who I can become, Hashem, the promise is that He will help us. Every individual person. That's it. Doesn't mean that he's going to split the Red Sea for you, but he will give you that help. If you really want the help, he will give you that help that you need. If you really want it. Doesn't mean that he's going to, make you a millionaire and marry a beautiful model or whatever fantasy a person has. That's not what the Hashkacha is about. It's not giving you whatever you fantasize. If you are reaching out your hand to Hashem in a honest, sincere manner, and you're doing it in a thoughtful way, Hashem will, as it were, will extend His hand to you. That's the principle. That's what Hashkacha is. So it's not in the realm of Hashkacha is there to help out, solve all my, Hashem is anything good that I had. Because God changed the natural order for my benefit. You know what I'm saying? Oh, I got the tuna fish at $1 a can versus $2 a can. Oh, that's an act of Hashkacha practice. That's not what the realm is. It's not categorizing that realm altogether properly. So that's the basic idea.
Is there a question on that?
Ask me a question.
How does a person really want something that's going to affect what really happens, You know what I mean? Like the guy.
Let's say if the guy
really wants something as opposed to he just wants it, so.
No. Okay, so let me clarify. Clarify that. In other words, let's say a person is really making a a real serious self-assessment. And they have a real interest to develop. And they realize that they have a certain block. And they can't get and they need help on that block. And they know that if they were able to get over that problem, they would be transformed. And they just can't. They themselves, you know, they try this way, they try that way. I mean, they can make a simple situation. Let's say a person realized that.
So obviously, it's not to say if a guy is just like a little short white Jewish guy, and he really wants to become an NBA player.
He will never become an NBA player. No. It's not about.
He really wants it.
No, it's not. That is a mythology that somehow that our American culture fosters. If you really want something, if you really try, you can be whatever you want. First of all, that's not true. Because anybody watches, anybody knows. You know, we're right now in the middle of the NCAA. Playoff season and going to the on the quest of the Final Four. Just think about how many. So you start off with 64 teams, and all those people who are starting are pretty darn good players. How many of those guys are actually going to see the NBA?
Very few.
So I'm a Jewish guy who sometimes starts on the varsity team of some yeshiva league team. What chance do I have?
Zero.
That's it. Zero. No, not close. Zero. Absolute zero. You will never be in the NBA. I will tell you right now with absolute certainty. Jeanette, no. And not only that, I could have told you the day after you were born. I could tell you before you were born. Because genetically, you are lacking the fundamental elements to make you into an NBA. The person who is an NBA star was made genetically at the moment of conception. Because if you're a 5-foot guy, you're done. You need to be, you know. Okay, there's going to be the rare exception. But still, that's going to be a 5-foot, 8 guy who can jump 5 feet. Something ridiculous like that, you know.
That's even a more rare thing.
Right,
it's
even more rare.
He's the exception, you know.
Right, he's the exception of the exception of the exception, exactly.
Like, if a guy's got an unbelievable, like, sports psychology type of thing, that's even more rare to have, you know what I'm saying? So it's
right.
Almost impossible.
Right.
So, you know what I mean? But in order to make up for the physical stuff, that's even harder to do.
Absolutely. So the basic point is that this is not saying that's why it says, I'll say haba, you know, to do whatever you want, God will help you out. Not true. It says, but every person is capable of transforming themselves and having a uniquely superior relationship between themselves and Hashem.
So this is only in the area of perfection.
Only in the area of perfection.
Objective human perfection.
That's it.
Okay.
Yeah. Not. Yeah.
Clear.
Right. I'm being very clear. In every other part in life, there are objective challenges which you can, you know, based upon the natural, you can. Let's say, take golf for example. A person, if he has just average talent, if he puts in a certain amount of time, he puts in 10,000 hours, he might become a 95-90 player. That's it. There's nothing he can do to get better than that. You might have the rare day he might hit a 78, but he is going to be. He is. There's a ceiling. Just genetically, you know, all the environmental and the genetic limitations. That's it. And that's but we don't call it human greatness. So that's it. But in the area of real human greatness, there is no bounds. The sky's the limit. Okay, for every person. But there has to be a real sincere effort to want that. You have to want that. And you may not need help to get over, and there's many challenges that I put
so you need help in the area of your relationship to God.
Exactly.
Okay.
Now that might be getting certain breaks along the way.
Right.
Which might in the natural order. You might get a certain job, you might develop a certain relationship, you might get a certain book, you might get a certain in these situations things might help in your way.
So in terms of like a job though, it doesn't apply to a job because
yes it does. It can. Because you might be at a job where you'll meet somebody that might be transformational.
Right, but it's not necessarily going
to... Or, I want a job. I want to support my family, but I want to be put in a job where I'm going to be confronted to be involved in Geneva. I'm going to give you a situation. A person found himself, he needed to have a job, and he wanted to working in electronics, one of the electronics stores in Manhattan. And they're one of them that where you... The way that the competition is so tight... The way they'd be able, their margin were so thin, the way that they would actually make money is by misrepresenting what they would call gray market products, which are basically things which are not, you know, they basically have to do So you have to be, as a daily basis, bait and switch, I tell you this, oh, but it doesn't include all the things you expect them to, you know, all kinds of fraud. He had to do fraud for a living. Okay? So it was a real bakash that, you know, for his perfection, I want to be able to support my family and not have a job that requires fraud. Simple example. So that would be vital. You know what I mean? And that's not so simple if you're talking about a person's entire, imagine that, you know, it's like a time like right now where there are not that many jobs available. People are getting laid off all the time. And he's in a job where every day he knows he's going to violate many biblical commandments. The other choice is not supporting his family. So that's a very harsh, challenging situation there. So I know such person. And he was able to get out of that. You know what I'm saying? So it's not so, you know, they're going to have the hard, it's not limited to having the harsh Sinai revelation of the great insight of the highest, you know, secrets of the Torah. Even you would call a normal everyday level of perfection. I want to be in a situation where I'm not being forced, I'm not being tempted to be involved in you know, fraud and deception. That's also perfection. Removal of negative is also perfection. I don't want to be in a situation I'm tempted. Or other, there are all kinds of temptations in the workplace. Okay? I mean, do I need to identify them? Do anybody need one more examples? Or can your imagination start to open up a little bit? Okay? I'll throw out another one. Another guy had a horrible situation. He's a yeshiva graduate, yeshiva day school graduate, K-12. A very good family. Working for one of the major finance institutions. And, of course, he was, you know, the first 5 years he had to work like crazy hours. And this is one of the firms that worked by teams. And in one of the teams happened to be just a very beautiful girl. You know, graduate from Yale, Asian, okay? And, you know, it's 11 o'clock at night, anyways, kind of long story short, he had a 3-year relationship with her. They didn't tell anybody because he was really embarrassed, but, you know, things happen. But it ended, you know, he's able to turn the ship around. He needed some tahara there, okay? That was an unfortunate, it was a very difficult situation there that he found. So it's not so simple. When we're talking about seeking perfection, we're not talking about having these great lofty ideas, even be able to have a basic level of perfection. You know what I'm saying? Not being involved in fraud, not living with a non-Jew. It's not so simple. As a rabbi, I get the inside scoop on all the sorts of the Jewish people. Okay, so I think that's I think I've explained the basic principle. I mean, the Ramban gives more psukim. He also points out since the average person is somewhere in the middle, not being quote unquote ignored by Hashem, not being constantly protected by Hashem in every 24/7. Therefore, we see that as we did a couple weeks ago, the Kohen who was appointed comes before the army and says, "Anybody who's afraid." Now, 1 second, if the guy is under complete protection, why is he afraid? Because he's afraid because he has reason to be afraid, because he knows that he's not Mr. Perfect Sada guy, and he knows that if he's out there, he might be, shall we say, getting the wrong side of the sword. You know what I'm saying? So the Torah expects that not every Jew is on the highest level. In fact, there are times that Hashem tells David, "You go there. Don't attack the army in front. Go around the back way and bring 10,000 men." What is it telling him? Because the Jewish people were not on level, they were divine, get absolute divine providence. Like by Moshe, he fought the Midianites with what? 12,000 people. Done. Which was an unbelievable victory. So that's the basic point. So have we captured the idea here tonight? Yeah, Dave.
So you say that the reason why God is able to help out the individual that's trying to seek perfection. So is it because that the odds are so stacked against him, so now he's coming in?
Yes.
So, I mean, that's
right, because he's real because the natural order is against him, yes.
Natural order is against him. So it's the same idea also, like you were saying, by the and also same by thing. The righteous thing. Just by same.
Right. He's fighting to go upstream against very harsh currents.
I see. So then Ashkafa is willing to meet him.
Throw him a line. Because he needs a line. Because he's not going to make it.
The odds are really
good. He's going to get nailed. He's not going to make it. He needs that help. And in order for Hashem to sort of allow a world where there can be a choosing the good, there has to be a help of those people who really are trying to improve themselves.
So if the individual, it's against the natural order, what he's really trying to.
Well, it's not just that. It's the cultural factor. It's the cultural forces. It's all kinds of. There's myriads of problems. Myriads of problems.
Things are really stacked against him in this situation.
Yes. Even with having the terrorists, it's not enough.
Is this a guaranteed thing?
Is Ashkacha product guaranteed? Yes.
Even for the individual?
For the individual, to the extent their motivation is for their relationship for Hashem.
Doesn't mean that no harm will ever come harm.
But I think we said
No, it's a continuum. It's an extended. That is that their operating principle? Is that their focus in life? Is that their real interest? Or is that an occasional interest? Is that sort of like a hobby? Okay, that's the question. The only person can know that. You know what I'm saying?
So according to that, you're saying that they always have to be thinking about it?
Is there, the Ramban thought that it's a great to the extent that they can. You can't say I'm going to be a Sodom Gomer. You can't be who you can't be. In other words, I say I'm going to be Avraham Avinu. No. You have to be the best Loren you can be, and within that framework, whatever the next step is. There are next steps to make breakthroughs on.
So let's say, particularly focus on this area for like an hour throughout the day.
Okay, fine.
That's their potential.
Well, that's working on a problem, but exactly. I mean, this is not limited to, I don't say the most genius people. It's not, by the way, perfection is not necessarily linked to supreme, powerful intellects here. Not limited. It's a certain kind of category of awareness, and also more important is the realm of brutal honesty, brutal self honesty, and honesty about what's happening in the world.
Most people can't come to that realization because they're too.
But apparently there's always moments where a person has where that choice is before when they get a little glimpse. Question: are they going to go for the glimpse? Are they going to follow the glimpse? Or is it going to turn the volume on the TV a little higher so they don't think about it too much?
Or have a back problem so they don't focus on it.
Whatever the way of distracting, whatever the way they want to distract themselves.
Kishkor.
Okay, whatever.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but also, Lauren, just to take that, go back to that example. So you have somebody who's maybe who's trying very hard and who's trying to gain knowledge. And he's persistent with it, and it's important to him. So maybe he'll run into somebody that will give him over an idea.
Right.
Be Ashkafa.
Right.
So
or
mean that now nothing is ever.
Or could it be that they were just vegging out a little moment on the southern state, and they were able to turn the car back, and they were allowed to have a good situation.
God's perfection doesn't mean that they got into like a terrible car accident. It could still happen.
The Ramban argues that if the person is the Tzadik Gomor, and that's the totality of his focus, he will not have that to happen. He's making that step. He's making that
right.
Declarative
statement. But yes, the person's only half. Maybe he'll have some type of intervention,
yes,
but not
right.
A full intervention where nothing will.
Right. It's a subject to degree. It's a subject to degree. That's
so
what it is.
You build an army for all those guys and let them fight in the Israeli
army. One thing you can say about that guy is that he definitely doesn't have the protection all the time.
Exactly. And the key point is, now I want to leave in on one little point here. That One other thing that's interesting, we can really discuss this all night long, and there's, because this is really brings in the totality of the Torah in so many different ways. But I'll leave you one little point. There's an interesting observation, right? Jake made this observation, I think it's so true, is that those people who have the least knowledge of Hashem expect Hashem to constantly be micromanaging and intervening left and right in their life. And the one people who we know as being uniquely close to Hashem, Avraham Yitzchak and Yaakov, constantly said that they didn't expect it. Yaakov is about to have a face stand. Now imagine this. You are the father of the Jewish people. Your 12 children will be the tribes. Okay? You're told to go to back to Eretz Canaan. He now has a face stand with his brother, who is not happy to see him. And he says, he prays, he does everything he does. He prepares for war. He doesn't assume, well, I'm going to bail me out. He does the diplomacy, and he davens, and he says, I've been diminished. I'm not really worthy of all this kindness. So ironically, that the people who are on the highest level are really, they get the hashkacha, but in a sense, they're always surprised. Because their knowledge of man is such how frail we are, how many, you know, tsaras that we have, and even that it's so easy to slip up because man is such we're such instinctual beings, we make mistakes all the time, that when they got the Ashkacha, they were just sort of like, amazed. Their reaction is always amazement. They're like shocked that they're getting what they're getting. So it's interesting. So the person who has on the lower level, they expect it every time, everything. The person who is the high person does not really expect it because they know that the reality is very complicated and there are other considerations and they know that they can't necessarily, that even their knowledge themselves is not so good. So it's, you know, so he knows that he doesn't think of, in other words, basically he's not thinking about a special project. I'm doing the right thing and that's it. A great story was one of the earlier, there was a Rosh Yeshiva of Chavetz Chaim came to America, it was the 30s or the 40s, and they were having tremendous financial difficulties. And they just couldn't pay anybody. So he told his Talmid, I got to get a job. And he went to go work at, working at a haberdashery, which is a men's clothing store. And so the student said to the guy, he said, Rebbe, well, what about the Torah? What's going to happen? If you shut down the yeshiva, what's going to happen to the Torah? So he said beautifully, he turns and says, look, it's not my Torah, it's Hashem's Torah. You take care of it. Meanwhile, the reality is, ain't kemachin Torah, I got to get a job. And I'm going to deal with the situation in a responsible manner. And we did at this point get we don't seem to be getting hashkacha practice here, so I'm now going to go work because I have to support my family, and that's it. And that's what he did. He didn't say, like, oh, it's destined, there must be a yeshiva, and under every circumstance, and that's it. Reality's not so simple that I can start making God, lo machshavo sechem machshavo. Hashem says, my thoughts are not your thoughts. Now, the irony was that that couple days later, the money came together, and they did reopen yeshiva. That's it. So, the bottom line is, you can't start, it's destined. It has to happen. Not so simple. We're not starting to play. Start to jump into Hashem's consideration. Where we say Mishpatecha Hashem Tehom Rava. God's justice is extremely deep. It's a deep abyss, which means that we have to be honest. We don't know. All we know that this is a principle of our. We see this throughout the Navi. This does exist. Another beautiful pasuk. I'll end with a beautiful pasuk. It says it's from Tillim. Ein Hashem. We say it in Sukkot Zimra every Shabbos morning. Ein Hashem El Yireyav. The eye of God is upon those who fear Him. Hamiyachlim Lachazdo. Those who seek for His kindness. That's it. That's where the idea is right there in the pasuk. The person who seeks it. You're a seeker. You're a questioner. You have a thirst for it. That's it.
Right. So it doesn't apply to like if a guy wants to like make a lot of money. It wouldn't apply to that. Like, who said that's even a good thing for the guy?
Right. It would ruin him. Now there is an interesting principle which we can discuss another time, which we can't do it. Which is Bederach Shalom Hola Molichimbo. In a way, the person's traveling, God sort of lets them go. Okay, that's something I want to... Right, something to think about. We might as well do that another time. It's another sort of a counter principle.
Continues to flow with the current.
That's
down
it.
The
down the stream or down the bowl. All right, on that note, we'll leave you. All right, guys, it was fun.